examples. And then what it would do, France would actually sell the finished goods that it used in those two examples back to Africa at above market prices. And this is what's called Francafrique there at the bottom. Yes, that's how France, as a colonizer, took advantage of Africa. Next up, let's go to the year 1945. You have the birth of the CFA franc. That's when that happened. It created those two currencies, the Central African CFA franc, and then that would be this banknote, for example, from Senegal. And then you had the other, which is the one from Congo. So these are the two different currencies that it actually created. In essence, it controlled the monetary sovereignty of 14 nations. These 14 nations made up nearly 200 million people. All right? Now, let's look at the way that they controlled these countries in terms of the money distribution. Now, member states deposited half of their exchange rate. It went to the French Treasury. These are the exchange reserves. Additionally, you had another 20% that was deposited for financial liabilities, as it's called. This meant that member state had access only to 30% of their money. So obviously that doesn't sound like a fair shake at all, especially when you have to deposit that much of your money and you don't have access to it. So that's another way that France exercised its CFA franc monopoly. When all that's said and done, France had a very cozy setup. It had 14 African countries set up to provide it with the raw materials, as we discovered, at rock-bottom prices. Manpower, low wages, to help it with its manufacturing. And then on top of all that, it had these countries deposit their money at a central bank, which then France turned around and generated revenues from that. You couldn't have a better setup than that. All right, let me now bring in Mahdi. He joins us to tell us what's coming up in his section. Mahdi, did we leave anything out from how France controlled its colonies?
Hi, Kaveh. There are many other ways that France is making money off its former colonies, and these methods are short of stealing money, like what France does with the CFA franc money in the French Treasury. I will cover that at length in the Quick Take section.
All right, thank you for that. We'll find out more from Mahdi, obviously, in his section. Now let me bring back our guest for our Q&A here. We have Dr. Charles Sincala rejoining us, economic and senior researcher in governance for a member of parliament. Dr. Sincala, welcome back to Economic Divide. So I'm looking at France and how it used its relationships with these countries, of its former colonies, that is. But in the aspect of the leaders that were chosen to be in power, there was obviously a relationship that benefited both. But we're looking at how there are coups that have happened recently, one after another. Gabon, Niger, the Ivory Coast also. Now the French grip appears to have been broken. I mean, why do you think these countries are rising up at this particular time?
Yes, Cameroon, Burkina Faso, Mali, Cameroon and Eritrea, most of those nations has been infested by coup d'etats. You know, what happens in the African continent, it's a short of money, the short of currency, the short of resources in terms of the currency that they have dominated, the United States of dollars. And, you know, governments are installed by those who have interest that the United States of America, France, Russia, they've got companies which have got the military complex where they contract their military mechanism. The part of the military budget, I think it is an average of $460 million budget to guarantee them that they won't be coup d'etats. But these are the ones who actually perpetrate and install presidents.
All right, thank you for that. Let me bring back now Kwame Gonza, Director of Operations at Connect Africa, who rejoins us. Kwame Gonza, welcome back to Economic Divide. It's very interesting how we're looking at the respective countries recently, such as Niger, such as now Gabon, and then we're looking also at the Ivory Coast, where the governments there, the people basically don't want it, and you have a transition taking place, whether it's to a military transitional government or otherwise. But people have realized that the resources of the countries is not working to their benefit. France obviously had a relationship with the heads of state which benefited both, but not the people. Give us your take as to why we're looking at things happening at the rate they are at this juncture in time.
Yeah, so I think the financial success is dependent on whether the government represents the current which takes over after the one which represents the neocolonial interests or the colonial interests represents the people. So that is where that kind of success will come from, a government which cares for the people. We have seen that in places like Burkina Faso, for example. We have seen that in Niger and Mali so far. In Gabon, we are not sure. So these coups are not the same in many cases. When colonialism was abolished, various territories remained divided. And so they remained vulnerable to that manipulation from outside. And this is what our forefathers were trying to fight against when they talked about unification, so that we can be able to.
Across the France-Afrique spectrum, France still today controls the currency, foreign reserves, the comprador elites, and trade businesses. France de facto controls the overwhelming majority of infrastructure in Francophone Africa. It is a virtual monopoly. Multiple French giants are operating in Africa, like the French conglomerate Bolloré's control of port and marine transport throughout West Africa. Then there's Bouygues Vinci, which dominates construction and public works, water and electricity distribution. Total has huge stakes in oil and gas. And then there's France's big banking, Société Générale, Crédit Lyonnais, BNP Paribas, to name a few. France has for decades made sure that there's very little intra-Africa trade. There have been attempts by African leaders to get rid of French control. Back in 2019, it was announced that the West African currency would be reformed and replaced by an independent currency to be called ECO. However, ECO would still be pegged to the euro and the burden that it implies.
Non ha un'identità culturale precisa, non ha...
Neocolonialism is on the move. Look at what the UK and Germany have done in Africa. But let me tell you, France has to be held accountable the most for what's happening in some African countries. Europe must act now to give back to Africa a prominent role.
The project is, however, yet to materialize. The growing unpopularity of France in Africa and the younger generation's rejection of its presence are no accidents. There cannot be a French-American solution to Africa's challenges.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apossian. We want to take a look at the other ways France makes money off its former colonies. One of the ways is through the exchange rate from the CFA franc to the euros. Initially, the CFA franc was pegged to its French counterpart at a rate of 1.7 to 1, but in 1948 it was increased to 2 to 1 by overvaluing the CFA franc. Paris maintained its economic advantage while crushing Africa's export competitiveness. The transfer of the money to the French treasury is another way that the French government makes money off its colonies. Not only can they not use this money as collateral, sometimes they have to pay the French central bank just for keeping it there. We know that the CFA franc denominations are in euros, but when accounts are in credit, the African central banks effectively place their foreign exchange reserves at France's disposal. But when the central bank's accounts are in debit, they are obligated to pay interest to the French treasury. In other words, CFA member states pay France to hold on to their money. There is then the question of what France does with the money that is deposited in the French treasury. There are two very realistic things that France can do with that money: pay off a portion of its debt or invest that money at a profit. The total amount deposited by the CFA zone treasuries is around 15 billion euros. That's half of their foreign currency reserves, and it is refundable. With interest rates around 1%, they could produce about 150 million euros at most. There are speculations that this figure could be a lot more. According to this entry by a German newspaper, Africa pays 400 billion euros per year to France, which said the French government collects from its former colonies each year 440 billion euros of taxes. Finally, the exploitation of Africa by France wouldn't be complete if it didn't include two important sectors, natural resources, and then the one not that well known, and that is West African ports. It is no secret how African countries are rich in natural resources like uranium, gold, and oil and gas. Niger provides around 20% of France's uranium needs. Meanwhile, Gabon is a source of crude oil. Mauritania delivers iron ore, while Togo and Benin provide agricultural commodities. And now comes the icing on the cake. French national Vince Boulevard owns most of West Africa's major ports. It is no surprise, then, that former French president Jacques Chirac had this to say about Africa. We have to be honest and acknowledge that a big part of the money in our banks comes precisely from the exploitation of the African continent. Without Africa, France will slide down into the rank of a third world power. That brings us to the end of this quick take.
Mali, Niger, Gabon, Burkina Faso, the countries continue to topple the Western Aligned governments, opting for new rulers, which, after the transition period, well, they're going to elect a leader that's going to work for the people, hopefully, using the natural resources of their respective countries. Now, former French colonies have realized alignment with France did not bring them what they deserved. After all, they truly need to get beyond what means of livings they have now, at a minimum. We'll find out if that happens. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in to our program. If you have any questions, any comments, we truly appreciate it if you send it to us. From Ikove Tahwe and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
Judicial Watch, an American conservative activist group, has filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, for its role in the infamous intelligence community letter that claimed the Hunter Biden laptop story was Russian disinformation in the run-up to the 2020 election. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. The Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, has been sued for its role in helping to craft a letter from 51 intelligence officials discrediting Hunter Biden's laptop as Russian disinformation. The letter that was signed by 51 intelligence officials in 2020, immediately before the presidential election, falsely claimed that Hunter Biden's laptop had all the classic earmarks of a Russian disinformation operation. A Republican report released in May showed that the CIA was actively involved in getting signatures for a letter which was a political operation to help elect Joe Biden in November of 2020. Government watchdog group Judicial Watch filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit on Thursday, 17th of August, after it failed to receive requested documents from the agency regarding the internal crafting of the letter. The GOP report charges that an employee of the CIA may have helped in the effort to solicit signatures for the statement, and charges former Deputy CIA Director and Acting CIA Director Mike Morrell and the Biden campaign of conspiring to quickly get the letter approved. The House investigative report notes one signer of the statement, former CIA analyst David Karians, disclosed to the committee that a CIA employee affiliated with the agency's pre-publication classification review board informed him of the existence of the statement and asked if he would sign it. The CIA employee asked Karians if he would sign the statement, to which he agreed. The report continues, the committees have requested additional material from the CIA, which has ignored the request to date. On 19th of October 2020, Morrell sent the CIA the final version of the letter to the pre-publication classification review for evaluation and called it a rush job so it could be approved. Fox News Channel has also covered the same story and tells us more. The new report also revealed that former Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, provided editorial advice to strengthen the verbiage. On 18th of October, emails included in the report showed James Clapper emailing Morrell his intention to sign onto the letter. He also offered a key phrase to include, writing, "I have one editorial suggestion for a letter. I think it would strengthen the verbiage if you say this has all the classic earmarks of a Soviet or Russian disinformation operation rather than the feel of a Russian operation." Morrell replied that Clapper's suggestion was accepted and it was a good one. Morrell testified before the House Judiciary Committee that a 17th of October call with Biden's current Secretary of State Antony Blinken had absolutely triggered his interest in coordinating the letter. However, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has claimed that he was not behind the infamous letter, insisting that he doesn't do politics. The Secretary of State claimed, "One of the great benefits of this job is that I don't do politics, don't engage in it." Antony Blinken said on Fox News Channel, "But with regards to the letter, it wasn't my idea. I didn't ask for it, didn't solicit it." At the time he was behind the letter, Antony Blinken was not Secretary of State, but a Biden campaign advisor. Asked by Fox News host if he accepted the laptop's legitimacy after most major news organizations have verified it, Antony Blinken said he would not talk politics. He claimed, "I'm not engaging in politics. I've got a lot on my agenda, some things that was just talked about, trying to help the Russian aggression against engaging with our allies, partners around the world and dealing with some of the challenges posed by China. We have a situation now in Sudan. This has fully occupied my time." President Biden and his campaign at the time cited the letter to discredit Hunter Biden's laptop as a Russian disinformation campaign. The then-presidential candidate cited it during the debate with Donald Trump just a few days after its publication on 22nd October 2020 to deflect scrutiny from his son's foreign influence peddling schemes. Then-Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe said at the time that Hunter Biden's laptop was actually not part of a Russian disinformation campaign and had made that clear to the FBI and the larger intelligence community. The Republican report also detailed how the CIA coordinated with the Biden campaign to shop the letter around and gain press coverage. Former CIA senior advisor Nick Shapiro drafted a media pitch that he sent to a number of media outlets, including Politico, which ended up writing the initial story. Current White House Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates, who was serving as Biden's campaign rapid response director at the time, was included on emails from Shapiro regarding the push to disseminate the letter to the media. The website of Slate News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Tom Fitton's Judicial Watch has filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, for its role in the infamous Intelligence Committee letter that claimed that Hunter Biden's laptop story was Russian disinformation in the run-up to the 2020 presidential election. The lawsuit is demanding all communications of the spy agency's pre-publication classification review board regarding a 19th of October 2020 email request to review and clear letter signed by 51 former intelligence community officials characterizing the Hunter Biden laptop story as having all the earmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign. Fitton said, "It seems the deep state CIA engaged in election interference and a political operation against the American people to help Joe Biden and hurt Donald Trump." The statement added, "And now the CIA is ignoring Freedom of Information Act law to cover up its role in the scandals censoring and suppressing the Hunter Biden, Joe Biden laptop story just before the presidential election."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
But I believe that we are at the cusp of an even more dramatic breakthrough, an historic peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
The Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on Israel-Saudi normalization. And here he is again.
I think that under your leadership, Mr. President, we can forge a historic peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
The Saudi Crown Prince seems to echo the same sentiment.
Every day we get closer. It seems it's for the first time a real one, serious. We're going to see how it goes.
Two problems here. First, just days ago, it was said that Saudi Arabia had abandoned any normalization talks with Israel, which was reported widely. Yet when the Saudi Crown Prince was asked about it, he said,
"There were reports that you had suspended talks."
No, that's not true.
The Saudi Crown Prince, however, has said the issue of Palestine is of utmost importance.
For us, the Palestinian issue is very important. We need to solve that part.
Question is, how important? Is it a non-negotiable, or is it open for negotiations?
We have a good negotiation. Let's continue.
Now comes the Saudi foreign minister, who had this to say about it at the UNGA podium. to paraphrase his statement, peace that allows Palestinian people to have an independent state with Al-Quds as its capital. If that's the case, Israel-Saudi reconciliation is a non-starter. There's no way that neither the Israeli Prime Minister nor his far-right extreme fascist cabinet would agree to it. So what is the deal? Why is Saudi Arabia wasting time talking to Israel? How can Netanyahu say that he cares about the Palestinian cause, yet say this about their position?
But I also believe that we must not give the Palestinians a veto over new peace treaties with Arab states.
And while talking about the importance of Palestinians, his forces murdering Palestinians. Just today, two shot in the head, bulldozing their homes and detaining them. Is Saudi Arabia serious that it may reconcile with this apartheid regime?
Credible nuclear threat.
The Israeli Prime Minister was up to his old antics at the UNGA podium, using his props to make a point, a red marker and a piece of cardboard.
Today I bring this marker to show a great blessing, the blessing of a new Middle East.
This new Middle East that he talks about, referred to by Iran as West Asia, has already happened. It's called the Iran-Saudi reconciliation. Further proof of that, Iran's foreign minister hooking up with the Saudi FM in New York on the sidelines of the UNGA, where there was talk about a comprehensive cooperation agreement with Riyadh. But there's no denying there is a conflict of interest when it comes to Saudi-Iran reconciliation versus a possible Saudi detente with Israel in more ways than one. And what about the U.S. and the U.S. President Joe Biden, whose hand the Saudi Crown Prince has rejected on more than one occasion? The U.S. has been more cautious than the upbeat assessment of Israel, saying things like a breakthrough is far away and steep obstacles remain. But perhaps a point overlooked by the media may provide a window into what the real intentions of the U.S. is. One of the reasons behind the U.S. enthusiasm behind denormalization, countering China's inroads in the Persian Gulf. This was a clear reference to China's Belt and Road Initiative, a stance supported by the Israeli Prime Minister.
That great promise in the G20 meeting that you participated and led, you spoke about an economic corridor that would link Asia, the Middle East, and Europe together. And such a corridor will make Israel a very important hub on a highway of unprecedented prosperity.
The U.S. and Israel, through the trade route, as shown here, want to stand up to China's One Belt, One Road initiative. And as the saying goes, kill two birds with one stone through this strategy. But will it work? Consider this. China is Saudi Arabia's number one oil customer. Saudi Arabia has just become a new BRICS member. Saudi Arabia has reconciled with Iran, with many PGCC Persian Gulf countries to have done the same or are in the process of doing that with Iran. That's called the New World Order. It would be wiser for Netanyahu to reconcile with his own people, who have protested for over 38 weeks, before aspiring to reconcile with Saudi Arabia. As the crisis in Europe begins to deepen, there are concerns in Germany that the country will become the continent's, quote, sick man. Deutsche Bank CEO Christian Suing said Germany will become the sick man of Europe if structural issues are not addressed immediately. He said, quote, it is also true that there are structural weaknesses that hold back our economy and prevent it from developing its great potential. We will become the sick man of Europe if we do not address these structural problems now. The Deutsche Bank CEO said the biggest task lies with banks. Soing also listed other issues that Germany is facing. They include high and unpredictable energy costs, slow internet connections, outdated rail networks, digitalization backlogs, a lack of skilled workers, excessive bureaucracy, and long approval procedures. The term sick man of Europe was first used to describe Europe's largest economy in 1998.
The European economy is doing better than the German economy. Germany is the sick man of Europe in the moment. There has been a decline in manufacturing output trend-wise since 2018. It's not a short-term phenomenon. And that has to do with the automobile industry, which is the heart of the German industry, and many things hinge on that. So we are on a declining trend. And then comes the war. Putin cut off the gas. Germany shut off deliberately its nuclear power plants, and one wonders where the energy should come from.
As it tried to grapple with the challenges of the post-reunification environment, the EU's largest economy continues to grapple with challenges in its manufacturing sector as it suffers from higher energy costs. It officially slipped into a technical recession in the first quarter of the year as GDP growth was revised from zero to negative 0.3%. The Bundesbank announced that the economy was likely to shrink this quarter thanks to slow private consumption and the increasing weakness of the industry. Germany's energy-intensive sectors, particularly manufacturing and automotive production, have borne the brunt of the disruption of its gas supplies from Russia. These industries constitute the bedrock of Germany's economic might, and any disruption in their operations has far-reaching consequences. Some firms are contemplating relocating their production facilities to more energy-stable regions.
Germany has a big problem with, or had already a big problem with skilled labor, but now it's a shortage of overall labor, even unskilled labor. And this has started in the pandemic when many people who were working in low-paid jobs, they found different jobs in different industries that rose during the pandemic, but they are now missing in other jobs. And some people also left Germany. Others came, but they were not so well integrated into the labor market. So in general, we have this shortage of labor in Germany, and we also have problems with supply chains. There were lots of disruptions. There are, of course, the war in Ukraine.
Earlier in September, a report by Spanish daily El País cited analysts who believe that Germany is staring at the end of its economic model. According to experts, the German model hinges on three ingredients, which include cost competitiveness, technological leadership in its industry, and geopolitical stability. But following the breakout of the war in Ukraine, all these factors are now gone. The cutoff of Russian gas, which accounted for more than 50% of the gas consumed in Germany, has impacted the electro-intensive industry, forcing businesses to restructure their business and to close plants. Meanwhile, the IFO business climate indicator for Germany declined for the fourth consecutive month to 85.7 in August 2023, reaching the lowest level since October 2022.
But what is true is that we are currently economically not in a good shape. We are probably in a recession, going into a deeper recession. And there are a lot of worries about the future, the economic future, and also there's a lot of uncertainty. And one thing in Germany is the inflation, rising prices has always been a big issue in the German history and in the back in the minds of the people. And so I think the rise in inflation in the recent years is also something which is leading to these results.
The significant deterioration in business morale suggests that Europe's largest economy has not yet overcome its challenges. Berlin's chances of reversing the situation in the short term remain slim, and the political landscape, a three-party coalition in government, does not make it any easier. The broader repercussions of Germany's deindustrialization and its aging workforce are looming, casting a shadow over the European Union's economic strength and competitiveness. Meanwhile, Berlin is planning to restore a 19% sales tax on gas and heat deliveries from the end of this year. The move will effectively end the current discount rate 3 months earlier than planned. The value-added tax on natural gas was cut from 19% to 7% last October to ease the pressure on consumers amid soaring energy costs. A recent report by the German economy minister projected that gas prices in the EU's largest economy are likely to soar and remain high until at least 2027, unless additional emergency measures are taken.
Yeah.
emotional reunion. Two of the five Iranians illegally detained by the U.S. have returned to the Islamic Republic, their homeland, reunited with their family. The crime? Conducting business, which the U.S. claimed had violated U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, the five prisoners held in Iranian jails have also been freed. Their crime, far more serious than just conducting business. They were charged with spying. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his team conducted very difficult behind-the-scenes talks, an arduous task since Iran and the U.S. cannot negotiate directly. Thanks to mediators in Qatar and in Oman, the release has taken place. This was deemed as a great accomplishment for the Raisi administration on humanitarian grounds. The Iranian president has promised that it would safeguard Iranians' rights and fight for Iran's rights at any cost. Incredible double standards are at play in the way Western media covered this story. It seems like the media forgot that the U.S. had imprisoned Iranians, illegally at that, in their prisons, emotionally covering the released prisoners from Iran, while condemning Iran and its officials. Not even scant coverage of the prisoners of the bereaved families on the Iranian side. One of the prisoners held by Iran on spying charges, Siamak Namazi, was a businessman held since 2015. He thanked the U.S. President Joe Biden for ultimately putting the lives of American citizens above politics, as if the Iranian president had not done that. But the politics Namazi is talking about is out of U.S.'s own doing. The sanctions-obsessed U.S. uses its sanctions policy to twist the arm of nations into following its foreign policy line. Even on the day of the prisoner release, U.S. sanctioned the former president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He was Iran's president 10 years ago. Additionally, the U.S. sanctioned Iran's intelligence ministry, and just days before that, it had sanctioned 29 individuals and entities in connection with what it claimed was violent suppression of nationwide protest, including Press TV. In the case of Siamak Namazi, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage and cooperation with the U.S. government and foreign intelligence networks. His company, Atiyeh Bahar Consulting in Tehran, was associated covertly acting with the U.S. government's companies anti-Iranian in nature, like the VOA TV channel, the U.S. government's Institute for National Strategic Studies, INSS, at the Pentagon's National Defense University, and the Office of Iranian Affairs at the U.S. State Department. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is in New York for the yearly UN General Assembly meeting. His spokesman said the message of Iranian President to the world is, quote, peace, justice, confronting discrimination and domination, unilateralism and terrorism, and the West supporting terrorist groups, the main messages of the Iranian nation. True to his word, since he came to power, the Iranian President has fast-tracked Iran's relations with a host of nations, extending his hand of friendship and peace to leaders from Latin America to Africa to West Asia and to the East with Asian countries. Yet the U.S. has described this government as what it calls a rogue terrorist regime. Question is, has Iran done anything to fit that description? Does Iran go and confiscate the earnings of another nation, forcing the country that has those funds to hold it hostage? Or does Iran go and confiscate another country's oil tanker at sea, which in essence is a form of piracy? In this case, the U.S. reason, it was a sanctions enforcement operation. These types of sanction-driven acts, however, have come back to haunt the U.S., along with its allies, like its European partners. Countries have realized that it is not Iran that has rogue elements, but the U.S. The sanctions regime, the weaponization of the dollar, and its foreign policy agenda has left the U.S. isolated on the international stage. Organizations like BRICS and the SCO are testament to that. Countries are rejecting the U.S. approach and are aligning themselves with each other. So when the U.S. and Western media are accusing Iran of executing a hostage and ransom act, this line doesn't have many buyers, especially when it comes to the topic of prisoners. The country that has the most number of prisoners inside its jails cannot accuse another country like Iran of being rogue, never mind the illegal torture that takes place there. The U.S. also has no credibility when it supports a regime like Israel, which detains and jails people without charge or trial, almost on a daily basis. This is while Iran, inside the country, has pardoned thousands of prisoners on a yearly basis based on Iran's leader discretion and approval. So the Western hostage and ransom narratives against Iran doesn't hold ground. Western pundits and so-called rights groups fail to mention Iranians languishing in U.S. prisons. They accuse Iran of falsifying charges against the prisoners, like spying charges. Maybe the U.S. needs to be reminded how it was spying on Iran on a massive scale during the time it had an embassy in Iran. But the U.S. doesn't learn its lessons and continues down a path of failed maximum pressure campaign, a failure admitted by U.S. officials. This is why Iran will continue down its path of imprisoning anyone suspected of spying and acting against Iran's national security, as it has done countless number of times.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has killed 6 Palestinians in occupied West Bank and Gaza. Raid on Jenin killed at least 4 Palestinians, with another Palestinian killed near the fence between Gaza and the occupied territories and another in Ariha. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, a 19-year-old Palestinian man was fatally shot by Israeli regime forces recently when they raided Aqabat Jabar refugee camp. Israeli regime special forces raided the camp in Ariha in the occupied West Bank's Jordan Valley in order to carry out arrests. Residents confronted the invaders who opened fire with live ammunition, hitting several people, according to the official Palestinian news agency Wafa. Derqam Mohammad Yahya Al-Khras was evacuated to Ariha Hospital with gunshot wounds to the head, where the teen was later pronounced dead. Since the start of the year 2023, 13 Palestinians have been killed by the Zionist regime forces in Ariha area, as occupation forces have stepped up raids, searching and ransacking dozens of homes and detaining residents, Wafa reported. The recent attack came after Israeli regime forces killed at least 4 Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, one of them a 15-year-old boy. 3 Palestinians were killed and at least more than 30 wounded, one critically in Jenin refugee camp in the northern West Bank city recently. A fourth Palestinian died recently from wounds sustained during the previous night's Zionist regime's attack on Jenin. Defense for Children International Palestine said that Rafat Khamsia, 15, was leaving his grandfather's house when he saw Israeli regime special forces exit three vehicles with Palestinian licenses and surround the home of the father of a Palestinian man wanted for arrest. Rafat ran away while yelling, "Special forces!" DCIP added, "One Israeli troop chased Rafat and shot him in the abdomen from a distance of 10 meters. A Palestinian man approached Rafat to offer aid when the Zionist regime forces fired another shot towards the boy. DCIP said the Palestinian man threw himself on top of Rafat and rolled him toward his house, where the boy was sheltered by the man's family for around 90 minutes, during which time the Israeli regime military prevented ambulances from accessing Jenin refugee camp. Rafat died before the arrival of an ambulance. Defense for Children International Palestine said that the boy is the 46th Palestinian child fatality at the hands of the Zionist regime forces and armed civilians so far this year. The Zionist regime launched an airstrike on the refugee camp while ground forces surrounded a home belonging to Muhammad Abu Baha, reportedly the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Jenin. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades is nominally affiliated with the Fatah faction headed by Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas. PA security forces have pursued a campaign against armed resistance activists following the Zionist regime's two-day military operation in Jenin refugee camp in early July, the largest such offensive in the West Bank in two decades. A total of 13 Palestinians were killed during the incursion or later died from their injuries, and an Israeli regime force was mistakenly killed by troops. The Zionist media said that the military arrested two Palestinians reportedly affiliated with the Islamic Jihad resistance faction. Palestinians in the camp declared victory after both the Zionist regime's withdrawal following the July incursion and the raid. In both cases, Palestinian resistance factions said they had anticipated and thwarted the Zionist regime ground forces. The Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, said that fighters engaged in a heavy firefight with a special forces unit that had infiltrated the camp, prompting the army to send in reinforcements. The resistance group added that several improvised explosives were detonated during the raid. An explosive device planted on a road was detonated in a precise ambush of an armored military vehicle, the Qassam Brigade said. The Zionist regime newspaper Haaretz said that while the military was withdrawing, an explosive device detonated near one of the army's vehicles, causing it considerable damage. The paper added the vehicle is currently awaiting rescue, which requires the military's engineering tools. The Quds Brigades, the military wing of Islamic Jihad, claimed responsibility for the precise detonation of two improvised explosives, causing severe damage to the Zionist regime military vehicles. The Zionist regime's military said it used a suicide drone against armed Palestinians who endangered its forces. Palestinian outlets reported that the Zionist regime forces targeted the main transformer in the camp, knocking out the electricity supply. In addition to Ra'fat Khamsia, Mahmoud al-Saadi, 23, and Mahmoud Arabi, 24, were identified those killed during the Zionist regime's attack, raiding Jenin. Al-Saadi had been previously detained for 75 days by security forces in Jenin. Recently, medical officials in the West Bank announced that 29-year-old Yasser Atta Musa had died of gunshot wounds sustained the raid in Jenin recently. The UN Human Rights Office in Palestine said recently that each death must be fully investigated, and where there is evidence of the unnecessary or excessive use of force, those responsible must be brought to justice. The UN office added that it was concerned with the Zionist regime's use of weapons more typically associated with hostilities, including autonomous armed drones during it, what it described as a law enforcement operation.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the representatives of the people from the provinces of Sistan and Balochistan and Fars Khorasan. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on September 11, 2023. It was during the month of Ramadan in 1362, according to the solar Hijri calendar. So you see, the memory I have from the regions goes back to that time. The people of Birjan wanted to attack the police station on the day of Ashura to get me out of there. That is the decision they had come to. The late Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Tahami's acumen did not allow that to happen. He stopped the people and told them that if they were to attack the police stations, it would create problems for me. What am I trying to imply here? I want to say that back then the people and the scholars were with the revolutionary movement. We were not alone. I had gone to Birjand alone, but Birjand with all its people and the great scholars that live there were with me. So that is regarding Birjand. I went to Zahedan during the month of Ramadan that same year. There were two great scholars in Zahedan. There was a top Shia scholar, the late Ayatollah Muhammad Kafami Khorasani, and the top Sunni scholar, the late Maulavi Abdulaziz Mullazehi. I was arrested there too.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the middle of the month of Ramadan, they arrested me in Zahedan, brought me to Tehran, and took me to Qizilqale prison. The late Kafami openly showed his support for us, and the late Maulavi Abdulaziz issued a ruling in line with what we had said. I don't remember the exact date of that ruling with regard to the time of my presence in Zahedan. I don't remember how long it was after that or it was at the same time, but this ruling was in line with what I was doing, The details of that ruling are long, and I won't get into them now. That is a memory I have of that place. So the first open move that I made in confronting the Taghut Pahlavi system was made accompanied by these two important centers, which are the capitals of the two provinces today, along with the people and their scholars. Of course, it wasn't just that. These things took place 15 years before the revolution in 1342. Shortly before the revolution, I had been exiled to Iran Shahr in Sistan and Balochistan. After the victory of the revolution, I was in contact with the Sunni scholars throughout Balochistan as well. Immediately after the revolution, since I was already familiar with the region, Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah sent me to Sistan and Balochistan so that I could see the situation of the people there and report back to him in order to take care of the things that were needed there.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Iraq started its war on Iran 43 years ago today. In the beginning hours, Iraqi bombs rained down on military bases and airports of the Islamic Republic. Within a few hours, a retaliatory operation was planned by Iran's air forces, codenamed Kaman 99. A gathering was held in Tehran on Saturday to mark the anniversary of this operation during the Sacred Defense Week.
The Air Force, as a force with rapid reaction capacity, intervened in a critical situation and bombed the enemy's bases. The experts in the world believe that our Air Force is not capable of confronting the enemy, but 140 airplanes carried out this operation, along with other airplanes that took pictures of the enemy's headquarters.
Iraq deployed 192 warplanes to attack 10 bases and airports on the first day of the war. But Operation Kaman 99 destroyed Saddam's ominous dream of conquering Tehran in just 6 days.
This operation turned the Baathist forces' dream of conquering Tehran in 6 days into a bitter nightmare. After 3 days, the Iraqi Air Force had no ability to confront the Iranian Air Force. And from here, Iranian skies became safe and the ground for the liberation of Khorramshahr was prepared.
Participants in the event also talked about the West's intervention in the war in support of Iraq.
The Western countries supported Saddam to attack Iran with the aim of destroying the Islamic Revolution. Saddam initially attacked the Air Force because he knew how important they were.
This operation and other operations that took place during the 8 years of Saddam's imposed war against Iran show the strength and solidity of the Islamic Republic, which has been achieved by the committed and expert forces of the country. Tehran.
Tehran.
1 year since the fatal shooting of black Londoner Chris Cabba, the British police officer alleged to have shot him in the head has been charged with murder. The officer, who's been granted anonymity by a court order, is known by the codename NX121 and has been remanded in custody, which means he'll stay in jail until his court case, which is due to start next year.